Welcome back or welcome to the Single Track Podcast. I'm your host, Finn Melanson, and in this episode, we are talking with Jason Koop, the head coach of CTS Ultra Running, author of Training Essentials for Ultra Running, and coach to many prominent athletes in our sport. In this conversation, we talk about whether and how the increasing professionalization of ultra running is changing the way athletes train and race and generally commit their livelihood to the craft. We talk about the potential for professional co-located trail running teams. We talk about doping and what policies should be put into place as soon as possible, and so much more. Before we get started though, this episode is brought to you by Rabbit. Rabbit makes the absolute best apparel in the trail running space, so if you're looking for new kit and want to support the podcast in the process, head over to their website and use code SINGLETRACK20 at checkout to get 20% off your next order. All right, Jason Koop, welcome to the Single Track Podcast.
Thanks, man. I'm excited to be here.
Pleasure to have you. And we were just talking offline. You are on the ground with athletes ahead of the Trans Gran Canaria race series this weekend. And it makes me want to ask you, I think you're relatively famous for traveling with a lot of your athletes and being on the ground at these races. In addition to all of the support that you provide them, have there been any insights that you've picked up in this sort of primary research that you might not get analyzing training logs and, talking to the athletes themselves? Like what's unique about that situation for you that you pick up from a knowledge standpoint?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, we live in a remote world. You know, I started coaching remotely. You know, I only coached in person for a very short period of my coaching career. And I've begun to appreciate actually being there for athletes during events more and more as my career has kind of gone along. And it's kind of along three fronts. First off, I have a better appreciation, particularly with the elite athletes, for just how hard they can go. And I'll never forget this sentiment. The first time I picked up on it was actually at the old North Face race, the North Face Endurance Challenge 50, and out on the cardiac climb. And, you know, there's a train of elite athletes going by, and I've got a pretty keen eyes and ears for how hard people are going just by being in our physiology lab for so long. And then also doing camps where we're kind of teaching people to use, you know, the rating of perceived exertion while they're doing intervals and things like that. And just sitting on the cardiac climb during the race and just seeing how hard they're going that deep into the race and thinking to myself, this is not what I would have expected based on the research. And then, so I go and look at the files, and I just happened to have athletes that were training in that area and use that climb very consistently. So I could kind of compare and contrast their training efforts to the race efforts. And the kind of the sole conclusion of it from a physiological standpoint is they could run at threshold for way longer than we probably thought of if we didn't have that touch point, or if you actually just look at the physiological research, which indicates that, you know, maybe you can do like 90 minutes if you're really good, or maybe 2 hours if you're really good. You know, they're doing that for not well in excess of that, but maybe 25 or 40% more time at intensity. And that was strictly driven through an observation that I had at that one particular race many, many years ago. And now we're starting to actually uncover, now that they're actually studying the physiological demands of races, we're starting to actually uncover just that. So that's the first thing, is just athletes can go a lot harder in these race situations, particularly the elite athletes. The second thing is I can usually provide some sort of counsel during the race, whether that be tactical information or just more emotional support, or, hey, let's triage this, you know, solution because your stomach went south or whatever. So I just using my coaching eye, I feel that I can help provide some sort of like material, you know, advantage as compared to not being there. But the final thing is, I actually think that this is the most important just from a coaching perspective, and it might not be any kind of insights that I've, you know, learn that people can kind of take away, but there's something about just being there. There's just something about showing your face at the event, even if you're not crewing for them, even if they have their own crew, which is a lot of the case. And that's the case here. you know, for this particular race. There's something about that that enhances the coach-athlete relationship far beyond what I can intentionally try to create throughout all of the conversations, throughout an entirety of training where we're talking on the phone, we're getting on Zoom calls and things like that. There's just something material about the quality of the relationship that improves just from showing up and being there. And so I value it as a coach. It might not be, you know, impactful from a, here's what we actually take away from it. But I value that as a coach very much because it not only makes my job easier, but it makes it far more effective when you have that enhanced relationship that can be fostered by showing up to an aid station and giving somebody a gel, right? Which is a pretty immaterial, kind of benign act, but it's extremely impactful for the coach athlete relationship. And that's probably the biggest thing that I personally and professionally get out of it.
You mentioned being at the North Face 50 a few years back and being amazed at how hard these athletes can push themselves, and maybe they can run at threshold longer than the current research would suggest. Do you feel like in general there are other things you are seeing with your own eyes and getting ahead of that, like future studies are going to bear out maybe 5 or 10 years from now about our sport?
Well, a lot of research starts with observation, right? We see this happening in the field, whether it's the field of competition or whether it's the field of practice. And we think that there is some sort of effect, or we think that the observation is in reality is what is going on. But those observations start the research process of, okay, now we're going to test this hypothesis, right? So I'm not going to say that I did this, but in my example, it would be, yeah, I observe these athletes running at threshold for an inordinate amount of time compared to what they think they can run at threshold. Okay, let's go and let's actually study this during a race that's similar to the North Face race with climbs and descents, and you can go hard on the climbs and pin yourself on the climbs, and then you get a little bit of recovery during the descents because they're not as cardiopulmonary as difficult. We're going to test the athletes beforehand, determine what their, you know, physiological ranges are, and then we're going to match those physiological ranges with what's actually going on during the race. So in a lot of ways, once again, the observations that we kind of like make in the field drive this, drive the research process to a great extent.
We're recording this on Friday, February 24th, about a week after the Black Canyon 100K. I think you were on the ground at that race as well. Do you think that there were any athletes in that field like a Keely Henninger or an Anthony Costales or a Tom Evans who were running at threshold for 5, 6, 7, 8 hours? Is that preposterous to think?
Well, maybe in a race like that, it's probably preposterous because it's predominantly downhill. And one of the things that we know about downhill running as compared to uphill running is it's nearly impossible to, in fact, I'll just say nearly impossible just to be technically correct, to achieve the same cardiopulmonary level of effort that you can in a flat level condition or an uphill condition. So who's to say? But one of the things I will say is one of the things that we're starting to appreciate more and more with ultra running, as we start to look more and more about what the demands of the event actually are, is that there's a vast discrepancy from event to event to event in terms of how fatigue is showing up with the athletes, what are the drivers of success, what are the physiological demands. And you can kind of start to create these like pieces of separation just based on the course profile. How much climbing, how much descending, what do the climbs actually look like? How long are they, right? Proportionally, are they an hour? Are they 10 minutes? That's going to have a different physiological determinant. And so when you look at something that it's very, that's as specific as the Black Canyon, it's a relatively runnable course, net downhill course, but, you know, has a lot of, you know, similar properties to parts of the Western States course and things like that, which makes it a good, you know, golden ticket race. You can definitely start to see how you would train differently for something like that as compared to a more mountainous 100K like the CCC, right? Those two things would look markedly different, or at least I would make them look markedly different, particularly in the latter pieces of the training process. We're just starting to understand a little bit more and more how that course profile and the environment actually impacts the way we should be training athletes for these things.
Spanning out a bit, you've been coaching in the sport for a while now. You're one of the most tenured coaches. What do you notice is changing the most in the way athletes are racing now compared to, say, 5 or 10 years ago? Or are there any significant differences?
Well, first off, is there's a more robust competitive landscape to draw from. And that's impactful for the elite athletes because they can always size up who's done what. You know, you never know how good a lot of these performances are until you get hundreds and hundreds of performances that are good out there. And then you can start to rack and stack them and then break the splits down and stuff like that. That's very difficult to do unless you have a robust competition history. So you take a lot of the newer races that come out there and we all get up in arms and probably make too big of a deal out of the course records that get set at some of these new races and, you know, things like that. It's like, that's great. But you got to remember, there's been like 3 people that are any good that have kind of like run these, you know, races that have just been run for a few years. So you've got to take those things with a grain of salt. So one of the biggest things is with that kind of robustness of the competitive landscape is the athletes can kind of be more precise with their racing. And they can gauge their effort and their splits in this kind of very narrowly tailored fashion using the previous history and their own kind of innate, you know, their own innate way to gauge intensity to really drive performance. I mean, you look at, you know, a lot of the course records and things like that that have happened. Normally what happens is they run materially faster over like 10% of the course, right? As opposed to 1% faster over the entirety of the course. And usually that's a manifestation of just having a greater degree of scrutiny across a lot of different performances of a lot of different good athletes and being able to dissect, okay, this is what is actually tolerable on this course versus, hey, this is not a, you know, tolerable pace or intensity or anything like that for anybody, because everybody that goes through, you know, whatever Twin Lakes, you know, at 1 hour and 42 minutes of the Leadville Trail 100, 100% of those people, you know, finish outside of the top 10 or something like that. It's just having that history that I think is extremely important.
Follow-up question to that, as the sport professionalizes, and this is two parts, but as the sport professionalizes, are athletes necessarily racing quote unquote smarter? And if it's even possible to be measured, are you seeing less blowups at the top end of these races?
Yeah, who knows? The difficult thing that makes that type of evaluation, or the thing that makes that type of evaluation difficult, is the landscape is so much more competitive year after year after year. So to say there are more blowup or more or less blowups, is that a byproduct of the athletes being smarter or the athletes just being better, or kind of a combination of both? Probably both. You know, they're learning from the athletes before them, not only in terms of how to execute the race, but also how to train for the race. But also when you get a better total pool of athletes, you should see fewer and fewer blowups, because it's the overall athletic quality of the individual that's kind of like the driving factor between that, you know, between that blow up nature. So I tend not to get too caught up in the weeds. You know, our mutual colleague, Liam, Aid Station Fireball, it's probably much better at teasing that data out than I am. but I think you could certainly say that the quality of the field is the thing that's kind of like impacting these things the most.
Well, cause like in one camp, one person might assume because there are more resources in the sport now, because there's more coaching in the sport, athletes are getting to start lines better prepared to meet the demands of the event. On the other hand, maybe one camp says because the sport is more competitive, maybe there is more risk taking to be more successful, and that would lead to more blowups. So I don't know if you have a strong opinion on either of those two, but I think that's where
well,
the question comes from.
I definitely think that there's more risk taking, and I completely agree with you that the tighter the competitive sphere gets every year, and kind of unquestionably that's been the case, where if you just take the distribution across the top 10 or the top 20 athletes in any of the major races, the differential between either the first and the 10th or the median to the outsides of the bell curve on that top 10 or 20, however you want to evaluate it, generally that trend line is just getting tighter and tighter and tighter. And when that's the case, you got to kind of run a little bit more of a, a little bit more of aggressive race if you've got those, you know, if you've got those high performance goals. But I also think in concert with that, the athletes are just better prepared. We have better knowledge. We have a better kind of ecosystem of support personnel, coaches, nutritionists, and even the support personnel at the aid stations and things like that to kind of like help serve the athlete. And so this aggressive pacing, if that's what you want to call it, is kind of counterbalanced by the expertise and the, and the physical qualities that the athlete is kind of showing up to the table with an improvement in those things.
You wrote a really thought-provoking Instagram post after UTMB this past September. And one of your remarks was that at the pro level in our sport, it's insufficient to marginally improve year over year. I thought that was really thought-provoking. Can you go into more detail about why you believe this?
Well, yeah. And the context of that was the performance of one of my athletes, Abby Hall, who was there, who, and she's on public record for saying this. So it's not like, you know, this is new information or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, she was second the year before and came back the year after with a very intent purpose of winning the race. We set the whole season up for that. I'm going to go win CCC. She was, you know, outwardly, that's kind of how, you know, how she was presenting the whole thing. And she improved her time by like over 50 minutes on the course and went back one spot, you know? And so I told her at the beginning of the whole thing, and this is, you know, my bad for not being able to extrapolate this. I'm like, if you improve by an hour, you're going to win. Like if you're that far underneath the course record, and I can't remember exactly what the math would have been at that point, but if you're that far underneath the course record, 99 times out of 100, you're going to win that race. But instead of winning, she goes back a spot and gets third. And I just, at that moment in time, I kind of thought to myself, it's like, everybody has to improve and you have to incrementally improve, but everybody is improving. The whole tide is rising. Not only each individual athlete is incrementally getting better, but there are more and better athletes getting into it. And so in order to improve your kind of like relative performance, so to speak, you can't get caught in the status quo of how much everybody else is improving. You have to improve more than that whole tide is raising in order to raise your stock in this. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this one caveat. That doesn't mean that you go around and do stupid shit. That doesn't mean that you chase around dumb training activities and, you know, increase your volume by 2x or anything like that. You can still make those gains with reasonable training approaches. But if you're looking at it from a competitive standpoint, you have to not only think how much it, like, how am I going to incrementally improve? You also have to take into consideration, how am I going to improve more than everything else is going to improve if you have the express goal of being better relative to the field. It's just a fact of the matter now, which is kind of cool. I mean, it kind of like,
oh yeah,
this is one of the interesting facets of an ever increasing competitive landscape.
One thing I'm curious about, and you referenced that women's race at CCC this past August, if you were to assign weights to what was responsible for such a dramatic improvement in performance for a lot of these runners, how much weight do you assign to purely just that total pool of runners being better and them pushing each other to, like you said, 50 minute PRs, hour PRs on that course?
I mean, it's a big part of it. I mean, competition drives competition. And this is the one thing I've harped on time and time again. When you have a very competitive landscape and you have high competitive density, meaning the top runners are all within kind of like earshot of, you know, trading places during the race, that elevates the level of everybody. And they kind of push each other to new heights. It's very hard to do that in uncompetitive races. And especially in the ultra marathon, you get an uncompetitive race and somebody wins by an hour or 90 minutes or something like that. It's very hard for that athlete to elevate their performance into these realms that you see in competitive races, because the drive just isn't there, right? They're kind of playing, you know, success by lack of failure at that point. And that is one of the things that is absolutely driving this, what I would term this accelerated performance within the ultra marathon landscape. It's not only are all the athletes getting better, but because they're getting better and there are more of them, that simultaneously raises the performance far greater than just the good athletes coming in, because they're all elevating their game, particularly in a competitive race. And there's no other way to recreate that in a time trial or in training or in uncompetitive races. You have to have that mix of those two things happening, everybody getting better, and then a lot of people kind of coming to the table in order to create a lot of these performances.
I just thought of this question, but we've been talking about this total pool of talent and the impact that has. When you think about the best that have ever done it in our sport so far, so a person like a Courtney, an Ann Trason, a Killian, do we already have an example of what the best possible performances look like in our sport, in addition to what aggregate best possible performances look like?
No, we're not even close. Like, once again, every year, you know, some course record gets broke and, well, this course record will never get broken, right? Kyle Skaggs' Hard Rock 100 record. And we can kind of go like on and on and on. And everybody looks like idiots who kind of called for these like records that are kind of unbreakable. We'll continue to get better. Yeah, there's going to be some sort of leveling out at some point in those performances, or, you know, marginally better as opposed to radically better. But we're nowhere close to that right now. I mean, we're very, very, very early in kind of drafting the competitive landscape in ultra running. And we're going to look back 10 years from now, and just like we're looking back now, 10 years previous to that, and saying, yeah, some of these course records, like they weren't all that fast. And we thought they were, but like looking at it, right. Just look at just look at the Western States 100 course record, which you could say arguably has had some of the earliest, most competitive times kind of put down on it. You compare the course record 10 years ago, some of the Scott Jurek course records, to what the athletes are doing now, it's night and day. And I love Scott. Like, this is no disrespect to Scott. Right, he was the best of his era. But unquestionably, it is a completely different ballgame in a relatively short amount of time. And we're not done playing out that particular ballgame. And we probably won't be for maybe 15 or 20 years before it starts to level off.
Are you suggesting that in the same way we're reevaluating Scott's career, we might reevaluate Killian's career in like 2030 and say, well, he was amazing for his era, but like this new guy is, you know, really putting that in perspective?
Maybe. And the reason that that's a maybe and not a definite yes is because Killian is so very special across every single attribute that you could ask for in an athlete in this sport. And whenever athletes kind of come around in those sports, they tend to have their performances tend to have a little bit more, not everlasting, but more sticking power. So there'd be a slight wrinkle to that, because I do think that just from everything that he brings to the table, it's so head and shoulder, it's so perfect, I guess, as close to perfect as you can actually ask of an athlete, that it's hard to trump that, even given copious amounts of time and professional athletic context to kind of layer on top of it.
We were talking earlier about, like, you know, will there be less blowups, stuff like that. One of the stereotypes in our sport right now, and I'm not sure if it's a stereotype, but I'll call it that, is that men tend to be more reckless runners. Women tend to be more patient, conservative, and they perform better in later stages of races. A, do you find that observationally and in the data that's true? And B, overall, are there differences in the way elite men and women compete in ultramarathons?
Well, I'll start with kind of the physiology of it, right? Because that's going to be more of my background as a coach. So for sure, women fatigue differently than men. And some of those differences can manifest in what I would call like a relative performance improvement compared to how men fatigue. That does not mean that women are going to start outperforming men in ultra distance events. And even despite the low participatory numbers, and once those participatory numbers start to reach par, we're not going to see that. I'll eat a lot of crow if that ends up being the case, but you'd have a hard time finding people who actually know what they're talking about to disagree with that. But I do think that because they fatigue differently, it manifests in kind of different racing qualities. And one of the things that you mentioned is just there are fewer blow-ups. It's certainly true. It's certainly true based on a lot of the pacing data that's out there that they do pace on the whole better than men. There's great data from the from UTMB, which has a huge, you know, kind of a huge data set, even though they have, you know, relatively small women because the total number of people is so big. They can actually kind of make sense out of this, that they end up pacing the race a little bit more evenly than men. And then in the later stages of the race, they can kind of like hold on to their pace a little bit better than the men. Now, what is that due to, right? Is that due to some sort of physiological quality that they have? I would say that there's maybe a little bit of it, but I would also say that it's a little bit self-selecting because particularly in Europe, if you're a woman showing up to the start line of UTMB or CCC, you're a fucking badass. Like every single one of them are total badass athletes. You cannot say that of the men. You look at a lot of the men that are like in the back half of the pack and they're just regular dudes with their pot bellies and skin a little bit undertrained and things like that. They are not badasses across the board. So a little bit of this phenomenon that women pace better than men, a little bit of it, not all of it, is just the fact that they self-select to be higher, like proportionally higher quality athletes than the men as a whole. But, and this is where I'll bring my coaching observation into it. Yeah. I do think that the women approach the races smarter. And that's probably due to a whole host of things as well. One, they're underrepresented, right? So they want to take advantage of kind of any and all opportunity that they actually have. But the second thing is the cutoffs are absolute, right? We don't age grade or gender grade the cutoffs. And because of that, what you will find is, and we've had these athletes at Leadville and kind of Western States for years, a lot of the normal women, the non-professional women, find themselves a little closer to the cutoffs proportionally than a lot of the men. And then therefore they have to be more meticulous in their training because they don't have, you know, quite as much bandwidth. And that just results in them being smarter athletes. The last thing is they're just smarter athletes, like women athletes. You could talk to any coach kind of across the board that works, you know, both with men and women, and they will probably express a similar sentiment that the female athletes out there, they, for whatever reason, they just have a better knack at these things. They're just smarter, more intelligent. They approach the sport in kind of a more calculated way when you look at it across the board. And I definitely see that in observation and also in practice, where the kind of just the level of professionalism that they bring to the game, whether they're professional or not, is just better than what the men are doing when you look at it on balance.
And are there marked differences at the very top of the sport? Like when you look at like a Tom Evans on the men's side and a Courtney DeWalter on the women's side, are you going to see those similar attributes play out at those levels as well?
I doubt that because they're all the elite athletes are also very, they're relatively homogenous as compared to when you broaden that lens out to everybody, that I don't think you can make a case for the whole group of elite athletes is different here, the same or in different in any kind of material way, because you get there for a reason. You know, everybody, I'm here with, you know, Courtney's at this race as well. I, you know, saw her and her husband Kevin, and they're great friends of ours. You know, everybody gives her kind of a little bit of grief for her happy-go-lucky attitude, but underneath the surface, she's a very calculated, meticulous, well-planned, and well-thought-out athlete. It just doesn't manifest itself in that way from a personality perspective when you hear an interview or you see her classic facial expression when she, you know, crosses the finish line or things like that. You kind of have to look through that to see the calculus that she actually puts into these races. So even in those examples, once again, you've got, you know, like I said, everybody kind of brings the same thing to the table once you get to that level.
Switching topics a bit, and this could be a function of all endurance sports in general, but it feels somewhat unique to ultra running. There are a lot of athletes in their late 30s, across their 40s, maybe even in their early 50s, like a Ludo Pommeret, a Jeff Browning, Ragnar Dabots, Heather Jackson, et cetera. They're all performing at an incredibly high level in our sport, what seems to me past their biological prime. So I'm curious, in your experience or from what you know based on the literature out there, when does an ultra runner peak when it comes to high level performance in our sport?
Well, there's for a long time, we've always understood this phenomenon where your physiological peak is different than your performance peak. Mm. And that happens across a range of endurance activities, kind of going down to the really down to the mile. And maybe you can argue even below that. But certainly at the 5,000 meter, 10,000 meter, and even the marathon, as an athlete progresses, you don't see a whole lot of physiology differences. You know, they're very, very nuanced. And usually if you're like testing it with a graded exercise test or in a laboratory, usually the sensitivity of the equipment is not going to pick up on anything material, but yet their performances can change quite dramatically. I think that is even more true from an ultra running perspective, where if you just look at somebody's pure physiological makeup in a lab, they're going to peak at 25 years old, 27 years old, kind of a really narrow range there, but their performance might continue to improve for decades. And that difference between when your physiological peak occurs and when your performance peak occurs has everything to do with how you execute the race, how you execute your training, the duties as otherwise specified that you can bring into the race, the mental skills and things like that. Ultramarathon is this complex, it was this really complex performance problem to solve. And I've often said that it's not simply a long marathon, even though the name might lead you to believe that it is. It is far more multifactorial from a performance perspective than a marathon. And the literature is actually teasing this out quite well now, where the same performance variables that we look at in a marathon do not explain performance and sometimes go in the opposite direction of performance at the ultramarathon. And so, yeah, absolutely. Because of that difference between your physiological peak and your performance peak and this multifactorial aspect of performance, you're going to see this difference in the ages of the high performing athletes skewing towards a little bit older. But I'll also counterbalance that with the competitive landscape is still developing. And whenever that is the case, there's opportunities for athletes who are not at their physiological prime or at their performance prime to perform well and go out and win races. So we have to, once again, we have to kind of remember that there's still not every ultramarathon is like super competitive. Let's just like face the facts. There's some of them that people can walk into and there are awesome athletes, but there's some of them that people can walk into with a reasonable degree of fitness and go and win. So that is certainly playing into this like age skewing as well. Just the competitive landscape not being robust across a lot of different races.
So let's assume that like 5 years from now, the competitive landscape has matured and it's fully developed, et cetera. In that scenario, would you suggest that these 40 plus year old elite athletes would be extreme outliers in those scenarios? Or is there something about ultras where actually from like a performance standpoint, it's possible to go that deep into your time on this earth and be competitive?
Yeah, that's a lot of speculation. I mean, probably it's if you want to compare it to a marathon, maybe it skews up by a few years. I can fully see that happening just because of all the multifaceted performance context that I was alluding to earlier. Whether it's 2 years or 3 years or 7 years or kind of whatever, who knows? That's beyond my speculative capacity at that point. Other than say when you compare it with marathons, yeah, it makes all the sense in the world that people are kind of coming into their performance prime, is what I would call it, right? Their performance prime a little bit chronologically older, right, than you would in any other type of event. And that follows the trend line if you go all the way down to the 100 meters, right? If you just draw that performance trend line across age, it's going to gradually creep up as you go up in distance.
I hear a lot of athletes remark that they have, you know, X number of matches to burn in their career before, you know, there's no more opportunity. And so I think that what they're trying to say is, like, regardless of when they enter into the sport, they have a certain amount of shelf life with peak performances. Is there any data out there that suggests that's true, or any observational data, or is that just sort of like in the minds of these athletes?
Well, I don't know if trying to determine a number like that is actually even relevant. I think what's more relevant is how you set up races within the context of long-term athlete development. And this is a term that gets thrown a lot around in coaching circles, but a lay audience is probably not that used to it. It basically just means how you use racing in conjunction with the training process to develop the athlete. And the fundamental shift, or the elementary version of the shift, is initially you're using the racing process to allow the athlete to learn how to race. That's part of the game. You have to learn how to manage aid stations. You have to learn how to manage fatigue later in a race. You have to learn what sort of, you know, foodstuffs that you can take in from mile this to mile that and underneath different conditions. You need to learn how to compete, right? Actually learn the skills of competition and when to pass people and when to kind of sit on your heels and how to be relaxed in certain situations and how to be very aggressive in certain situations. Mm. And you have to use racing to facilitate that learning process, because you can't do hardly any of it during the actual training process. You're very, very limited in your day-to-day workouts into how you can actually teach those things. So that's where you start with more high frequency racing, and what that number is kind of individual for each person. But as that athlete's career, especially the elite athlete's career, moves on, they have the need less and less to learn from those experiences, right? Because they've kind of taken this big, robust history of racing a lot. And then you can kind of cherry pick things out more. So I don't adhere to this this strategy or this philosophy that you only have a certain number of bullets. But I will say that when you first, and I would take this with any elite athlete, when they first start kind of developing themselves as a professional, as an elite athlete, you're certainly going to race more frequently than you are going to once they're mature and once they're developed. That pattern is one that I would absolutely adhere to on in almost every kind of athletic circumstance.
This is another, because you mentioned long-term athlete development there, and this just comes to mind. Is there a particular age where you think an athlete is well suited to come into the sport? Like, we've seen people as young as, you know, Jared Hayes enter the sport when they're like 15 years old. We've seen people come in like Heather Jackson when they're 38 years old. Is there like an ideal time to start building your practice in the sport?
I mean, four? I don't know. I mean, how far we can. So we mentioned, not to be too jovial about it, right? We mentioned Killian. One of the attributes that he brings to the table is he has been competing at a high level for a very long period of time. And it might not all be an ultra, but for a very long period of time. You cannot replace that. So I'm not going to say that there is an ideal way to do it, but as long as it's managed properly, and that is a key caveat. That is absolutely, everybody who's going to take me out of context and clip this last part out and leave clip the first part out and just leave the last part, shame on you. As long as it's managed properly, I really do think the earlier the better, because there's no substitute for the real thing, because that long-term athletic development proposition, then you're in the position of when you're 22, 24, 25 years old, you're cherry picking your races. Right? You're racing once or twice per year, as opposed to doing that later on down the curve. And I think you have a longer shelf life by doing that if you manage it properly, because you're spreading out this long-term athletic development program that you would kind of overarch for 20 years, right? As opposed to a one-year cycle. You're spreading that out over a longer period of time, and it's more likely to breed success. So I don't think that there's a magic age, other than to say that I would, if I were kind of like you had this question in your outline, so I'll already bring it up. If I was designing an elite athlete in a lab, I'd have them start doing at least endurance activity, maybe not ultramarathon activity, but at least endurance activity in a variety of different settings earlier rather than later, and then kind of graduate them as the as their maturity increases. That doesn't mean, I'm going to add more caveats to this because people are going to take it out of context, that all they do is ultramarathon since they're 6 years old. It doesn't mean that. That just means that you're incorporating the sport into their life with other things earlier versus later.
All right, I got to ask that ideal mountain ultra trail runner question now, because this was something that my buddy Brett and I were talking about on a run in Phoenix this past weekend. If you were to create the absolutely ideal 100-mile mountain ultra trail runner in a lab, what would the traits be and how would you weight them?
I don't know about the weighting, but once again, Killian's the blueprint. You have an incredibly high, if not one of the highest or the best aerobic engines that we've ever seen across any endurance sport, running, cycling, ultra running, skimo, cross country skiing, triathlon, you kind of name it. Killian's up there in terms of his maximum aerobic capacity, his VO2 max. He's up there with the Matt Carpenters and all the other people that have tested at the very, very top. That's a very small club, very extremely small, maybe four people, five people on it within each sex category. So you start out with that. You start out with that kind of like physical quality. And then you start out with lifelong exposure to the sport. That doesn't mean that they do the sport exclusively for their entire life, but they have some exposure to it over many, many years. And once again, going back to Killian's blueprint, he's running around the mountains barefoot since he was a freaking kid. Right, you can't recreate that lifelong adaptation, no matter how meticulous or how precise your training prescription is. If somebody comes into a sport brand spanking new in their freaking 30s, yeah, they can sure see success. But you know what? If they would have been doing it for the previous 10 decades or previous 10 years or previous decade to some extent, they're going to be a little bit better off. Let's be intellectually honest about the conversation. And then they have to have a highly tuned sense of who they are as an athlete. And some of that is innate. They're just born with it, right? They've got good parents. They've got good genes. They're an intuitive athlete. But a lot of it is developed through the course of deliberate practice, either just through yourself, as Killian has done. A lot of his, not all, but most of his training as an adult has been self-directed. But he's been doing it for a long period of time, and he's very good about saying, this is when I perform very well, this is when I don't perform very well. So he kind of has that keen sense of like what works for him as an athlete. So I think if you were doing this in a lab, you combine the raw physiology with the long-term exposure to the sport, and then an innate and a developed sense of how to adapt training, you've kind of got your perfect, athlete for any sport. You don't have to limit it to trail ultra running. You've kind of got your perfect athlete right there. And you look at all the greats, they kind of have like each one of those, not all of them, but the majority of them, they kind of have each, a little bit of each of those in there. I think Killian is kind of a hyper example of that, where he just started out so young and he's so good aerobically and he's so in tune with themselves that's what I'm saying. His records might last a whole heck of a longer than everybody else because he's really the perfect or close to the perfect of everything across all those categories.
You just made me think of this question too, because you talked about how Killian is self-directed there. And I want to get into this conversation about the professionalization of the sport, but do you think that being self-coached right now is sort of a vestige of this unprofessional era of our sport, or will there always be athletes like Jim Walmsley and Killian? I'm not sure if Courtney's coached. I think she's not. Will there always be those types of athletes at the high end of the sport that are self-directed and they're going to be okay in that environment no matter what?
There will be. I mean, that's just the inherent nature. You can't force everybody to have a coach or a nutritionist or a mental skills coach or a strength training coach or whatever. That can be completely up to the athlete. But I do think, I'll make kind of two points on this. First off, I think that all elite athletes are well served with bringing in professional counsel of some sort. And what that professional counsel is can be a whole host of things. And I just mentioned them, right? Coaching, which is what I do, having a mental skills coach who I, you know, I have those people in my like repertoire or my digital Rolodex, so to speak, that I can kind of lean on. Nutritionist, you mentioned, you know, Courtney, she has somebody help her out with her race day nutrition. Woman, yep. She wouldn't mention this, but I will. Meredith Turnova, who's, you know, very, very skilled in this, area. But the fact that you see elite athletes that don't have these kind of resources around them perform very well, you're always going to continue to see that. That doesn't mean that they're not, that they couldn't perform better with incorporating some sort of expert counsel. I do think that as the sport evolves, you will see less and less of those people because they're just not going to be able to compete. And I know that sounds like a totally, you know, maybe egotistical or, you know, self-serving type of statement, but if you look at the history of the parallel endurance sports, they've gone that same way too. You could be a professional cyclist in the 80s without having a coach. You kind of can't do it now. You got to be wrapped up with a coach and a team and a nutritionist and mental skills coach. You got to have all those things come to the table if you want to be on a professional tour team. Same thing with professional triathlon. You know, maybe in the 80s and 90s, you could get away with running and biking and swimming a lot, running and cycling and swimming a lot. Now you can't. You got to be super smart about it. You got to have access to a lab. You got to have your, you know, strength training coach and things like that. And it's just the level of competition kind of requires it. All sports have really gone that way. From at one point, you could get away with not having this professional counsel and compete. And then as the sport becomes more and more competitive, and as the density of that competition gets tighter and tighter, the athletes are kind of forced into the situation where they need to bring in outside counsel in order to raise their game incrementally more, to my earlier point, right? Incrementally more than the rest of the competition. It's just the nature of it.
What have been the biggest advances in the athlete-coach relationship over the last few years or decades that have made it an increasing advantage for the pros that do use it right now?
I would just say, I mean, you have to remember, before I coached ultra runners, I didn't coach any of them. You know, I had a good maybe 8 or 10 years of professional coaching experience, not in ultramarathon coaching. And that is not from a lack of trying. I actually tried really hard to kind of crack into the ultramarathon world. It was kind of a business objective that we had at one point.
Did you ask Scott?
I'm not going to get into who I asked, but that you would recognize their names. And I was routinely laughed out of those meetings. Like, not just no, like F you, you're stupid. No, like that kind of like attitude. And I gave up on it for a few years. I said, okay, you know, this is not worth my time to kind of build the business in this way. I'm going to focus my, you know, efforts in kind of another direction. And, you know, a few years had to transpire before that tide kind of like turned back. So just the fact that athletes are actually looking at it and kind of seeking it out, I honestly think that that's the biggest transformation, because now I don't have to create the buy-in. Right? I don't have to go and scout out athletes to go and coach. They come to me with the buy-in and say, I want this to be part of my village that I'm building around me to make me a better athlete. And whenever that's the case, whenever they have that initial buy-in, that's more transformational and more impactful from a coaching perspective than anything I can do on the programming standpoint. No matter how precise my programming is, or, you know, how accurate I'm evaluating this, that, or the other, if the athlete believes in what they're doing is going to have a positive impact, that supercharges all of the precise programming and, you know, really specific work and all the training architecture and things like that, that I can throw at it. So it's just the belief that it'll make a material impact.
One other advantage I want to ask you about is the team environment. This is a super popular thing in the track and field world where, you know, you have the Hansons Brooks team, you have the Brooks Beasts, you have Hoka Naz Elite, you have Tin Man Elite, all of these co-located teams in the track and field world. That model doesn't quite exist yet in trail. It's, if there are quote unquote teams, they're dispersed globally or nationally. If there were opportunities to come together and live and train in a place like Flagstaff, do you think that there would be competitive advantages for athletes to be in those group environments versus training independently?
I do. And I've said this for a long time. Orchestrating something like that, I'm not going to say that the parallels that are out there in the road world are quite the right model for this sport, because it is a different sport. We have to keep reminding ourselves that it's not just long marathoning, right? As I mentioned earlier, it is a completely different sport, and the models for athletic development, we need to tailor specifically to a sport. But I do think having some sort of group team environment or an orchestrated in the correct way is advantageous. And we don't have to look that far to find that. I mean, the Adidas Terex team, if you look at that with a critical eye, they are outperforming their competition kind of on every level. If you look at their athletes, they more consistently perform better than the athletes on the other teams. And shout out to Robert, who he single-handedly fostered this environment and this culture within that team, who you've had on your podcast before. From the onset of taking over that team, he has been very deliberate in not only who he's bringing on the team, but also how they are operating as a team. And for the very first time, I'll give you a practical example of how this actually kind of manifests in reality. Because it's one thing to say, yeah, it makes an impact, but here's how it does actually make an impact. For the very first time in my coaching career last year, I had an athlete that when we were going over their goals for the season, this athlete said, and this person was on the Adidas Terex team, said, I want to support my athletes I want to support my teammates at these races. I've never had that. Never, ever, ever had that in my coaching career. It's always, I want to win this race, or I want to get top three in this other race. I want to set a PR, you know, kind of over here. For that person to put that in their goal framework is a testament to the people and the culture that that team has built. And you see that reflected in the performances of their athletes that are, in my estimation, and a lot of other observers of the sport, are a notch above what the other teams are doing when you just look at the landscape of the pool of athletes that they have available to them. Teams are starting to catch on to that. Solomon has like a scientific support program that they're launching this year with my good friend Guillaume Mier, who's kind of at the helm of that. And I've sat in on their first kind of rounds of meetings with the athletes that I work with on the Solomon team. And that's going to make an impact too. So I think the landscape of this team environment, or having more support services kind of allocated towards the pool of athletes that are underneath a particular major brand, you're going to start to see more and more of that. It won't be exactly what we see on the road running side, but there'll be some similarities, certainly.
Yeah, when you think about the nuances or the changes that would need to be made for it to work in a ultra trail setting, would one of the big pieces be organizing athletes around the types of events that they're training for? Because I feel like for listeners out there that are thinking about this conversation right now, they're like, well, how would you organize a team where one of them wants to be a 100-mile ultra trail runner, one of them wants to do a 50-mile thing on the track, one wants to go do the Way Too Cool 50K. Like, there's just so much diversity within our sport. How do you organize around that?
Yeah. So that's why I don't think that where everybody's located in the same environment might actually, I don't think that will actually work, because not only is ultramarathon a different sport than a marathon, a lot of the disciplines within ultramarathon are completely different sports within each other. And you certainly would not train for those the same or even similarly, as my kind of allusion to that would speak to kind of on our earlier conversation with hilly versus flat courses and stuff like that. So I think that the solution that's more likely, or the solutions that we're going to more likely see, kind of have these anchor points within team camps and support services where the athletes come together for a short period of time in a camp type of environment, and or they're coming together sporadically for these types of support services that are available, whether it's nutrition or psychology or physiological testing or things like that. I'm not, and if I were designing it, if I could wave a magic wand and have unlimited resources and stuff like that, I still don't think, as much as I would want to, I still don't think I would set up like a permanent house, you know, at Flagstaff or Colorado Springs, which I've thought about for a while. That's my hometown.
Yeah.
I still don't think that I would, that I would do that from an elite athlete perspective, just because the training environment for all of these races can be just so very different. And that's such a big limiting factor.
When you were coaching athletes, or when you were getting into coaching, you mentioned earlier that you were getting laughed out of a lot of rooms when you were pitching the idea. And, you know, we're in 2023 now, and I'm wondering if you're observing something equivalent, some movement in our sport, some new adaptation for athletes, something to add to their Rolodex of performance that may also be getting laughed out of the room at this point in time, but that you think maybe 5 or 6 years from now, it's going to be absolutely critical in the repertoire.
Well, I think it's the building of the team. And I don't think that it's so much kind of like laughed at, but this element that you're a professional athlete, you should treat it as a profession. And as a professional, you need to bring the right tools to your job. The right tools are, how am I going to train? I need a coach. How am I going to handle my mental game? I need a mental skills coach. How am I going to manage my nutrition? I'm going to need a nutritionist. That kind of village building, I have athletes that do that. I mean, I have athletes that, you know, we have, you know, 3 or 4 people in the village and we all kind of converse at certain points of time. And I think those athletes are better served to that. I don't think that that's laughed at now, but I do think that the tide is turning so that more athletes are starting to build more robust villages around them, more robust kind of infrastructure around them as a professional athlete. And I think if we extrapolate that in the future, it's once again, it's going to be kind of a cost of doing business. You're a professional athlete. This is the cost of being a professional. You got to hire all these people. And currently the landscape is I take on these athletes for free, right? I coach them for free. I like doing it. I don't mind doing it. It's good for the sport. You know, I get a lot of enjoyment out of, you know, what I do from that perspective. There's probably a little bit of marketing that we get out of it, certainly. But trust me, I'm not making a living off of coaching the professional athletes. There's not enough of them, first off, and they don't earn enough to command that. We're not that far away from that, though. You know, the triathlon model where the coaches and other pieces of the support system, they take a cut of the winnings. That's a really popular model in triathlon, and to a lesser extent in cycling. They have a team model there, which kind of obscures things. But if you look at the triathlon landscape, a lot of the way that it works is an athlete goes and wins 10 grand at a race. They pay their coach 2 grand. They pay their nutritionist 1 grand, like whoever else is kind of on the payroll, so to speak. That's them treating their professional athletic endeavors professionally. They're bringing professionals into the equation and they are paying them when they are successful. I'm not in complete agreement with that pay for play model. I go out and earn and I pay everybody else, but some kind of professional compensation for the professional coaches that are working with the professional athletes, that's going to be something that becomes more de facto in the next 5 to 7 years, because the competitive landscape is going to really require it.
Yeah, I was just going to ask if you think financially 5 to 6 years from now, the vast majority of athletes are going to be full-time. Because like a lot of people right now, they're hedging, right? Either practically because there's not a lot of money, or just existentially, they can't wrap their minds around purely being a runner as a profession. Do you think that in the future, it'll be a lot different?
Yeah, there's enough economy going around, and that economy increases every year. And because of that, that total pool of dollars that's available is going to filter down to the athlete. Because that total pool is expanding, that's going to eventually filter down to the athletes. And so, yeah, while you see athletes right now on, you know, sponsorships that are like, you know, a couple tens of grands, 10, 20, 30,000 bucks or something like that right now, you're going to see them 80, 90, 100, 150K, things like that. Some total 7 years from now. I think that that's a very realistic number. And when you start getting into that, now you have a small business, a small professional business of being a professional athlete, and you need to invest in that business appropriately across a whole variety of different, you know, aspects. And one of them is just being the kind of the support structure that you have as a professional.
Is it fair to say that in almost every scenario, athletes are better athletes, better runners, better performers when they are full-time? Or is there any argument to be made that they can reach their potential hedging in a bunch of different areas?
I mean, there is, but I always add the caveat is as long as it's managed properly. I mean, the hard thing about going professional is you have a lot of downtime, right? You can't train 8 hours a day. Like, I'm a professional coach. I work 8 hours a day, right? You certainly can't train 8 hours a day. 8 hours a day. A lot of professional Ironman triathletes are pretty close to that. I mean, they're 30-hour physical work weeks, you know, and probably 45 hours once you include all the non-physical stuff, the planning and the, you know, prehab or whatever you want to call it, massage therapy, all those kind of things that don't count in the, you know, training stress score, so to speak, of the actual athlete. So the downside is you end up filling the time that you have available with activities that are counterproductive to the training. You don't Netflix and chill, as one of my colleagues would describe it. But once again, as long as you manage that properly, absolutely there's an advantage for becoming a full-time professional as opposed to not having a full-time professional. And part of, I mention this all the time, part of the advantage of bringing these people into the circle, and particularly a coach, when, and especially in the cases where, you know, I'm kind of the head coach, so to speak, but I'm also working with a nutritionist. I'm also working with a mental skills coach or whatever. The coach kind of like filters all of that information into the prescription. Part of the value add for having that is that integration, and also making sure that everything else from a work-life perspective is not balanced, but it's conducive to what you're trying to do. So in a lot of ways, the more professional you do become, it kind of gives you more opportunities to screw up. So you've got to bring people into the ecosystem that'll kind of like keep you honest, so to speak.
I know that the like total dollars aren't quite there yet for more athletes to go pro, but just based on what you've seen out there in the market, is there already a lot of brands that are doing a good job of making sure that these athletes get access to coaches like you, to mental coaching services in other parts of the market, strength coaches, you know, physio, stuff like that?
They're going to have to compete. I mean, once again, Adidas is they are setting the tone, and people are following it. They've kind of like set the tone with how they treat their athletes as partners, not as ambassadors or sponsees or anything like that. They're very much partners in the equation, and everybody else is kind of following suit. I mentioned earlier that Salomon's making this material shift to start to provide what I would consider a relatively robust sports science service support package. That was hard to say. Sports science service support package to their pools of athletes. And like with anything, everybody knows everybody else's business. And so in order to be competitive, the rest of the brands are going to have to kind of like not only offer whatever financial compensation that's kind of, it's not standard across the board, but you know, it's not all that materially different for most of the athletes. They're going to have to come up with these other things to essentially compete in what is a very competitive landscape. Let's not gloss over that fact. There's only a finite amount of really good runners out there to kind of vie for all of these sponsors. And whenever that's the case, you know, it's just like any job recruitment, you know, proposition. Whenever the job market is hot, you got to kind of come to the table with more than, you know, one, you know, trick up your sleeves. You got to kind of have the whole basket.
I want to ask you some questions about how people like myself and anybody else in this very small but burgeoning media space in our sport talk about ultra running. When you examine all of the pre-race, live race, and post-race coverage of our sport, so this is like athlete interviews, commentator banter, live coverage, stuff like that, what is missing from the dialogue? with the acknowledgement that we're not all, you know, PhDs in exercise phys and whatnot, but what are some principal things that we're missing in the dialogue that you would like to see added?
Well, first off, it wasn't that long ago where I was really lamenting having to refresh Twitter to figure out what was going on during a race. I mean, it was such an analog experience in a, you know, day and age where we're used to having drone coverage and kind of things like that. So I'm actually, I'm through the roof. I'm over the moon with where we're at and the coverage today. The fact that, you know, we can get some semblance of live coverage with a combination of drone footage, and the Starlinks have been a game changer to get those out to remote areas. We still are kind of finding our footing on the production side of things. So how to turn race coverage into like more of an entertainment product that can be self-sustained for the duration of the actual event, which is hard to do, right? These things are, you know, 10, 20 hours long, and that's a lot of content to actually fill. So, I mean, if I had my perfect world, it'd just be more backstory on these runners. You know, we tend to just like pull their lives out of what we see on Instagram and stuff like that. And that doesn't always paint like the best picture of, you know, of who they are. The commentators do a fantastic job with kind of working with what they got. This really takes a production team to do the background research and have the pre-production interviews and have B-roll footage and things like that kind of like queued up. But I think that that's the missing element is like, who are the characters of the story, right? Not just what their performances are and what they did in so-and-so race and things like that. How does that character development look? And what does that character arc look like? And how do we weave it into how the race actually unfolds?
For the fans and even the commentators that do want to get into the weeds of like what this athlete has been logging on Training Peaks and Strava and just getting into like the mechanics of the sport, are there any more substantive ways we can be predicting, evaluating, critiquing the performances of runners, in your opinion?
I don't know. I mean, you look at like the New York City Marathon, they always have like this hokey things like, oh, here's so-and-so's heart rate during this actual, you know, during this mile, or here's their pace between mile this and mile that. Nobody really cares. I mean, if you kind of go back to the Tour de France, they had live onboard power meters for a long time, and they would show those on the screen, you know, whenever they had an athlete on there. Here's their power, here's their spikes, here's their heart rate. The audience kind of doesn't give a shit. You know, they're into the actual racing, the head-to-head mashups, how the race is unfolding. So if anything, just illustrating like how the time chunks are unfolding, how the gaps are unfolding, and visualizing, like kind of data visualizing that aspect, I think is appealing to the consumers. All the physiological data and stuff like that I really care about, I come to appreciate that I'm the only one that actually cares about, and I'm fine with that. No. So I don't think that that's a key to kind of like unlocking anything. I think it's just the more mass market stuff that even the casual fans can certainly appreciate.
I think one of the reasons why I'm curious is because in other sports, like, you know, football or basketball, the mass market, the average fan is up in arms about like points per game and passing yards and, you know, rushing attempts and all that kind of stuff. And I'm just wondering if like, are there equivalent statistics in ultra running that the average fan would get stoked about and they'd want to see referenced by commentators?
I don't know. I mean, maybe if you dive into their training history or whatever, like miles per week, vertical per week and stuff like that. But I don't know. That's not my area of expertise.
Quick break to give you another discount code. This episode is also brought to you by HVMN. HVMN are my choice for exogenous ketones. Back in October 2022, I was introduced to exogenous ketones at the Javelina 100. After some testing, they became a daily part of my routine to support energy and focus, and I've even started using them in the middle of long runs to support endurance and recovery. In 2023, my nutrition plan will be both high carb and high ketone, and for the latter, HVMN will be my product of choice. If you're interested in trying them out yourself, use code SINGLETRACK20 at checkout on their website for 20% off your next order. With that, let's get back to the conversation. Well, anyways, one other topic that I want to discuss with you before we go is doping in the sport of ultra running. And the first question I want to ask you is, do you think there is currently doping in the American ultra trail running scene? And is the yes or no answer to that question relevant to how we craft policy in this area?
So the answer is unequivocally yes. And it doesn't have to be limited to America. I think that you can broaden that out worldwide. We'd be really naive to say that that doesn't exist. There are already instances in the international scene that it has been going on. People get busted every, once in a blue moon for this kind of stuff.
Not in America though yet, right?
Well, not in America, but internationally, certainly. And this is like one of those things, like how are you going to find something when you're not looking for it? Right. I mean, we don't do a lot of testing here in North America. So it kind of makes all the sense in the world that we can't find it there, or that we can't find it here. Not that we do a lot of testing abroad, but still. I think that the fact that there is doping going on doesn't necessarily need to influence the initial policy, but I do think the stage of which the cheating is going on should absolutely influence it. The sport right now is very clean. Let me just say that, like, that is my opinion. I think the vast majority of the elite runners out there are doing so honestly. They're doing it with integrity. They're doing it without performance enhancing drugs. And the actual cheating that's going on is very, very few and far in between. That's a good thing. The policies that are initially implemented need to reflect that culture. And when we start to go down the path of figuring exactly what is going on, you have to have the solutions to a certain extent. It fix the problems as they are, as they currently exist, or at least that's how we think they exist, with a little bit of future proofing. You can't, use a hammer type of solution to something that really requires a scalpel, right? And ironically enough, that's kind of what we're seeing across the limited landscape that there is we're providing, really, really stringent types of policy in an environment that really doesn't require, nor is it the best policy, is it the best policy for. So I don't think that the solutions necessarily need to fit, is there doping or is there not doping going on? I just think it needs to fit the kind of the maturity of the sport initially, and then mature as things go along. And that's one thing that I think people should appreciate more about anti-doping policy, is it needs to mature alongside the maturity of the sports, both in terms of the competitive landscape, but also how the athletes are cheating as well. Athletes are always going to try to find some sort of like loophole or game the system in a certain way. And the people that are trying to keep athletes kind of on the right side of the line need to adapt to that as quickly, if not forecast, what those athletes are going to potentially do.
You had an excellent, I think it was a 5 or 6 part series on your own podcast. Maybe it was in 2021 with all sorts of policymakers, subject matter experts, people in the trenches working on this issue. Can you talk in particular though about your opinion on what the policy should be in our sport? Like, what is the course of action for us? And maybe in like lay terms for this audience, because we're not as science-based as the folks listening to the KoopCast.
Well, I don't think it has to be my opinion. Right. Just as a little bit of a background, I have a little bit of an inside track into how these things get developed through just personal relationships. Two in particular that I've had with people over at USADA, the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. So two of their former chief operating officers, two of their former consecutive chief operating officers, I just happened to have a personal relationship with. The first one was John Frothingham. He was their chief operational officer kind of in the mid 2010 to about 2017 or something, maybe 2008, 2017. We'll put those as the bookends of it. I worked directly underneath him at CTS. He was my boss. He was my supervisor. He kind of like was my mentor in a lot of ways on the kind of the business side of coaching. And then then the CEO after that, was a name by the man by the name of Matt Sticchio. who I served on the board of a 501(c) with. So two kind of very serendipitous, you know, happenings where they have to be, where they were chief operating officers at USADA for a long period of time. And with each one of those individuals, I would constantly have these meetings with them, trying to grease the wheels and say, how do we solve this in this sport? Like, tell me what the framework looks like. And let's start to galvanize people around what that framework is. So this framework is coming from them. It's not necessarily coming from me. And it's really analogous to how you would treat any other Olympic level sport. You have the same educational qualities that the athletes kind of have to go through in order to participate in the anti-doping process. You got to teach them what's on the right side of the line, what's on the wrong side of the line, how to manage the whereabouts program, how to check your, you know, medications for, you know, being banned in and out of competition, how to use the global DRO, which is like a clearinghouse, so to speak, for all these types of medications and substances. This education piece that you need to bring athletes on board with. You have to create an athlete biological profile through a series of tests, both in competition and out of competition. And that's in order to look at the banned substances or the things that are showing up within the biological samples that deviate from the athlete's normal range. So you have to have that component of it. You have to have a component of it where athletes can submit anonymous tips in, because a lot of anti-doping control or anti-doping measures are done essentially through detective forensics, right? They get a tip from somebody, they send some kind of investigation in, and, you know, there's non-analytical positives, right? Non-analytical bans that happen all the time because they've received information from somebody, or they tune up the testing if they get a lot of, you know, tips from athletes, and they're also looking at the competitive landscape. So USADA assigns a person to each sport, so to speak, and they survey the competitive landscape. And when they notice anomalies in athletes' performances, they'll apply pressure. They'll apply testing pressure and things like that to those athletes, just to make sure that those performances are, and those performance improvements are anonymous. The next part is the sanctioning piece. Right, you have to have a sanctioning piece that has consistency across the entirety of the events. So if, you know, Michael Phelps, for whatever reason, tested positive for steroids while he was competing, whether or not he was competing in a world championship event or an Olympic event or some sort of qualification event, each one of those events is applying the same level of sanction, right, to that particular athlete for that particular infraction. So there's a blanket umbrella that gets cast over the whole ecosystem where everybody is kind of playing by the same rules from both the sanctioning perspective and also what is banned and what is not banned and under what conditions. Yeah. So they're adhering to the WADA code, essentially. So you have to have all of these common, these kind of like common elements. The difference is there's no national governing body. So an athlete that's on the marathon teams, 5K runners, 100 meter sprinter, whatever, they all fall underneath the jurisdiction of USA Track and Field. USA Track and Field says, okay, these are the pool of athletes that we want to test. These are the rules that we're applying by. This is the, you know, the kind of the WADA rule set. The athletes get co-opted into that group simply by being a part of the national team or kind of whatever criteria each team has. But what they have deferred to, both John and Matt, have deferred to this solution within the trail and ultra running side of things, where the first parts of all of that program are continuous. It's just like any other elite sport out there. They're taking the same rule set, same conditions, same testing procedures, same testing frequency, testing for the same, you know, metabolites and things like that. The difference comes in is who is the pool of athletes, because there's no sanctioning, there's no governing body to determine who the pool of athletes is and who actually enforces the sanctions. So in a national governing body, for example, all of the races and all of the events kind of defer to the national governing body in terms of who's sanctioned and who's not. We don't have those latter two elements in trail and ultra running, and there needs to be some, you know, some sort of collection of interested parties or interested individuals to kind of make up for that actual discrepancy. So what I'll say is the framework is there. I mean, they have been working on this for the past, and this is probably unbeknownst to just everybody, but just a very small, you know, group of people. I'm one of them.
Yeah.
But USADA has been working on this for maybe 7 years now, and they just can't pull the trigger on it. You know, it's not that they don't want to do it. They want to do it. They're principled people. They realize it's a sport that they can kind of get into the ground floor on and make a big difference. They can do it on a worldwide platform. That's an important part as well. It's not just US athletes. It would be a worldwide platform. And they have some semblance of a structure out there to how they would do it and where the money would come from and how the whole process flows from tip to tail. But they just haven't, for a whole host of reasons that they can explain and I won't. They just haven't stepped in the arena quite yet. It would help a lot if we had athletes and coaches and other vested entities continuing to pester them to step into the arena, because in my estimation, they're the best game in town. They're not the only game in town that could provide the solution. There are other entities out there that would be probably willing to do this, but they're the most reputable. They're the most efficacious. They have the highest integrity of any of the other alternatives out there. And I think personally that it's the best solution for trail and ultra running, for USADA to design something that the whole global ecosystem can kind of adopt.
There's a lot there, and I have a lot of questions off that. The first, you mentioned a bit ago that one of the components of this proposed system is being on the lookout for anomalies in performance. And I think I got curious about that because as our sport is progressing so fast and you can't really marginally improve every year to stay relevant, what happens for the next few years when every year is a performance anomaly?
Well, once again, they're experts at doing that. You know, whenever they adopt a new sport, they kind of deploy a person or a team of people to kind of survey the landscape and get their feet wet with it and say, okay, you know, this person was doing this year, they're doing this next year. We may or may not kind of tune up the testing for them. I do agree that because the unlike track and field, where the performances are relatively homogenous and it's easier to see those outliers, it's not quite as crystal clear. But you absolutely need somebody within the anti-doping kind of enforcement agency, and this is USADA, to take survey of the landscape and try to orchestrate the testing correctly. Because the worst thing that you can do is to just start blindly throwing tests at people. That doesn't serve any purpose. There has to be some direction to it. This is first off, from an efficacy perspective, if you can focus the testing where it's going to have more of a material impact, the entire program is more effective. But the second thing is just from a cost perspective. You know, it's very expensive to do these things. And everybody is going to be budget conscious, right? Everybody, even the national governing bodies, USA Triathlon, USA Track and Field and things like that, they're budget conscious about how much, you know, they can spend in anti-doping things, and USADA is conscientious about how much money they can spend underneath their a for-profit business, right? They don't do it for charity. And so they've got to direct their testing, that they're testing in a way that is effective, as well as have some kind of economical efficiency associated with it. And a lot of that efficiency is really centered around having somebody that surveys the landscape and kind of deploys the resources as strategically as possible, because you can't test everybody all the time, right? It's just, that might come, to be honest with you, maybe 10 years down the line. I mean, we're getting to a lot of the wearables. And right now they do dry blood spot testing, you know, quite effectively. And that's a very cost-effective way to do it. We're not that far away from having a continuous wearable kind of take the place of a doping control officer showing up at your house, essentially. But my point with that is whenever you're instituting some sort of anti-doping framework across a new sport, there has to be somebody that's working within that agency that can take a look at the sport and say, okay, here's how we're going to allocate our resources the most efficiently.
You said there that it's expensive to execute these types of programs. Can you talk for a bit about whether there's any controversy around athletes contributing money to the system that they might be tested by?
Well, so I'll broaden that up. I mean, USADA's biggest hang up is where the money comes from. So they've been very adamant in the past that they don't receive money from an individual or an individual entity. So Nike, for example, can't pay USADA. I asked them to do this, actually. I can't pay USADA to just police my athletes. Right, they won't take that directly from me because there's too much of a tie between the compensation that they're receiving and then the athletes that they're actually testing. So the biggest hurdle that they're having right now and the next step in this whole process, honestly, is getting their legal team to come to the table with some type of some type of framework or some kind of like do's and don'ts or maybe even an analogy of what this entity would look like that essentially funnels the money. It takes the money from wherever the money's coming from in the model that USADA is proposing right now. It kind of comes from everybody. It comes from the athletes. It comes from the brands. It comes from the races. It comes from the coaches like myself. It can come from anonymous donors, takes that pool of money or takes the money from all of those individual contributors, puts it into a pool. That pool then gets allocated to USADA on some sort of frequency on a monthly or quarterly basis or something like that. And then USADA kind of executes the program. And the reason they want that entity in the middle and the framework of that entity is kind of what's in question right now. The reason they want that entity in the middle is they don't want a direct tie from the compensation to actually USADA. They want some sort of buffer in between it. And that has always been the sticking point or always been the biggest sticking point whenever we've tried to get this off of the ground is who is that entity? It's not me. I'm putting my finger on my nose right now. I'm saying I've done enough work in this area and I'm not there yet. It's not Finn either. And I'm not the right person. But let's just face it. It's a shit job. Right. And this is one of the things that John impressed upon me when we very, very first started talking about this maybe a decade ago. He says, shit job. Nobody wants it. It's rife with criticism. It doesn't pay you anything. You get all the shit and none of the glory. Nobody wants it. And so who's going to step up to the plate to actually perform that function, to go out into the ecosystem and ask for a lot of money and, you know, we're talking anywhere between a $250,000 and $500,000 per year is what this is going to cost. When we look at, you know, a couple hundred athletes that are in the pool, that's ballpark figures. Who's going to go out in the ecosystem, ask for that money, then deploy that money into USADA, and then be the person to actually start to enforce the sanctionings piece. So USADA comes out with some sort of adverse finding. They recommend a sanction of 2 years. This entity then has to have some sort of system to enforce that sanction across all of the brands, across all of the races, across all of whoever the interested parties are. Nobody wants that job, right? That is not an attractive. I wouldn't want to take that job. Like, nobody wants that job. It's incredibly important, but that's what makes this so hard is this entity that theoretically needs to get formed. It's not that it's set up for success. It's just initially just a difficult thing to boot up.
Couple more questions on this topic. There's at least four buckets of people that I think should care about this for one reason or another: fans, athletes, brands, coaches, race directors, etc. Maybe we focus just on the fans for a second, because that's a lot of the people that listen to this show. Why should fans care about all this?
Well, they don't have to. I mean, you know, you're a fan of the sport. There's a lot of people in, you know, baseball and football. They don't care if those players are juiced to the gills. You know, they just want to see exciting athletic events, you know, so you don't have to. But what I will say is that particularly in participatory sports, where the people participate in the same events that their elite athletes and their heroes are participating in, that participatory sport connects more with the fans when they have a reasonable degree of assurance that the performances are authentic and unadulterated. That's very meaningful. And we've seen examples in the past, cycling is a great example of that, of where they lose their fan base to a large extent, certainly to maybe to a complete extent. They lose a large part of that fan base because of this cynical view that everybody's doped to the gills and I don't know what's real and what's fake and the performances are always better year after year, blah, blah, blah. The individual fan can determine if they care or not. But when you talk about the collection of fans and how kind of rabid and robust those collections of fans are, it's always better. You always have more enthusiastic fans when they believe what they're seeing is actually real. You could take it into like our professional league sport context. Whenever the performance we feel has been like screwed by the refs or like there's some sort of, oh, the field was, you know, this or the balls were deflated or something like that, we always lose a little bit of our enthusiasm for watching the sport because, you know, whatever tricks are kind of like going on in the background. And ultra running and endurance sport in general, I think can take a very big lesson from that, is that if you are trying to grow the sport, you are trying to create more engaged fans, you want them to kind of receive enjoyment around the sport that they're watching, it's always going to have a heightened connection with people when they know what they're seeing is real and authentic.
As you've been on this journey of activism yourself, has there been a particular category of people or actors in the sport that have been particularly difficult to mobilize in favor of more controls?
It's everybody. I mean, you know, people are going to hate on me for this comment, but everybody wants to talk and there's no action. And that frustrates the hell out of me. There are a lot of people out there that will yell and scream at the top of their lungs whenever there's an anti-doping infraction in any other sport, and we'll retweet the Athletes for Integrity's unit, you know, tweet of so-and-so got sanctioned, they get a 4-year ban. We'll retweet that with hashtag clean sport and yell at the top of our lungs that, you know, we need this and we need that. And all we need to do is test for EPO and kind of like whatever, but nobody wants to do the work. There's been very, very few people, and I'm one of them, so I can level this criticism. There's been very few people that have been at the coalface of actually doing the work to try to solve this, which is not easy. It is not easy. And so, yeah, there are a lot of people that it is absolutely infuriating to try to have conversations with them. And the infuriation comes from this discrepancy between bitching and moaning and we need clean sport and things like that, and actually doing the work. And here's something. If anybody wants to get involved with this, send me an email. I will put you in touch with the people over at USADA. We'll get together a working group or whatever and start to actually do the work, which is going to take a lot of time. You're going to have to dig into your own pockets with your own capital for some of it to start to get things, you know, seated and going. But that's where that's where the rubber is eventually going to meet the road. Now I'm hopeful, because ultra runners are kind of a resilient lot, but needless to say, I have been woefully underwhelmed at the lack I've been woefully underwhelmed at the actual action that the collection of people have taken with this. Some people have been great at it, but very, very few, and certainly it's disproportionate to the amount of bitching and moaning that we see across the space.
You said that to date there's minimal doping going on, at least in the American scene, and we're not at this point of cynicism about performances yet. In the climate movement, they talk about like we have 10 years left to decarbonize the planet. How much more of a grace period do we have in ultra running before things really go south exponentially?
Well, that's a good question. And this is the screw that I'm turning with USADA right now. They have the opportunity to come in and it's easy. There's very little course correction. You can do things and we can put in very simple, easy solutions, get everybody on board, start to get the snowball going down the hill. And the effort is not nearly as big as it's going to be when there's a lot of doping going on. I'm not going to put a specific time frame on that, other than to say with every passing year, it gets more and more difficult. It's always harder to unwind big problems than it is to stopgap small problems when they are actually small problems. Mm. And that's what we have right now. To be quite frank with you, the kind of the biggest issue that we have with any sort of anti-doping solutions right now, it doesn't have to do with the doping itself. It has to do with the education across the ecosystem. We are woefully undereducated in this whole arena, the athletes, the race directors, the coaches, kind of everybody. I can't tell you how many athletes and coaches that I know that have never used Global DRO before, which is a cornerstone piece of the entire anti-doping complex, where you can go and you can check any medication or any substance and get the entire array of when it's banned, when it's not banned, underneath what conditions, underneath what delivery mechanisms. So many athletes, I mention that word, and I might as well be speaking Greek to them. They don't even recognize like actually what it is. So the level of education right now is kind of our biggest hurdle to get over. That's a good problem to have. Like, we can deal with that. We can put material out in the space. We can get race directors kind of on board. We can get athletes on board and things like that. When the biggest problem you have is everybody's doping and you got to figure out who the cheaters are, and we see the sports where that's happened. That's a decade long problem to unwind. It's very, very, very difficult. You have to unroot the culture, the rotten culture that exists because of that, which is the hardest thing, because it's not just a mechanical switch. It's a cultural switch, and you got to get rid of the people, right? You got to get rid of the people to change the culture. And that just takes time. We're not there yet, but we will get there if left unchecked. That's a foregone conclusion. You can see any other instance of that throughout sports. When these things go unchecked, they just snowball out of control.
Well, we'll make sure to link to the mini series you did in the Coopcast about this topic, and I'll grab all other relevant links from you offline for the show notes. This has been excellent. Couple miscellaneous questions before we close up. First, you've had a lot of experience, or at least more experience than most ultra runners at the 200 mile distance in our sport. And I'm curious, I guess this is all mostly observational and experiential right now, but is there a specific training framework that is developing in your mind for these 200 mile events? And if so, what are some of the components? What are the differences between training for 100, for example?
That's a hard switch, man. I need to like decompress after the doping rant. You got me all riled up, man, because I've been, like I said, it's been a pain point of mine.
I feel you.
Anyway, here's the thing. You can only do so much. We only have so much training time and activity and things like that. So to say that from a training architectural standpoint, there's this marked difference from the 100-mile race to the 200-mile race, I don't know if that's kind of quite there, because we're already doing kind of everything we can. I do think from a race execution standpoint, the biggest thing is just how do you manage the sleep deprivation? And we don't have a lot of good answers to that. There's some research to indicate that some sleep deprivation training can alter your rating of perceived exertion. That's a marked, you know, that's not the same as altering your performance. It can alter your how you perceive your effort while you're actually sleep deprived. It would be a different leap to say that actually improves performance. But outside of that, there's not a lot of good methodologies to actually train for sleep deprivation. There is a lot of good methodology for how you prepare to be sleep deprived, and that's a completely kind of different category. And I think we have good interventions around that, which basically revolves around banking sleep. I know some of the sleep practitioners out there will kind of cringe at that vocabulary, but it's the one that most people kind of readily identify with, where you're just sleeping for longer, you know, 10 hours a night or something like that, leading into the event. But that's something specifically to handle the sleep deprivation. In terms of the total training complex, I don't know if we're doing, I don't know. It might take a while to actually tease this out. I don't know if it's all that different from 100 mile training when you look at it on balance. Maybe there's a couple overnight sessions and things like that, but certainly nothing that's like you look at it and it's markedly different.
Are you noticing any intrigue and adoption among elite athletes for this type of event? Like when you talk about, we talked earlier about like this pool of elite athletes that is just growing in, you know, the events like 100K and 100 mile. Are you seeing any inklings of this among elite athletes, or will this always be like a very indie type event within our sport for quite a while?
Who's to say? I mean, most of the elite athletes, not all of them, but most of them want to spend most of their competitive bullets competing against the best. That's kind of what gets their juices going. They want to go to the high octane races and get into, you know, battles with whoever kind of else is out there. And so that drives a higher percentage of the athletes into the UTMBs and the CCCs and the Western States and kind of things like that. You do see some elite athletes that have like a curiosity, you know, itch to scratch. And, I kind of want to see what this is. It's certainly not happening en masse, but it will start to happen en masse the more of those competitive athletes actually get into it, right? Back to my earlier point that they want to go and compete against the best. That just takes time. It just takes time to develop, and how long that time frame is, you know, who knows, but it's certainly not to an appreciable extent right now.
We were talking earlier about long-term athletic development, and I want to ask this question within that context. Is there a bad time in your ultra running career to do a super long trail FKT attempt? Like, should that be reserved for like the tail, like the swan song of your career?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I mean, after seeing Tim getting destroyed on the Pacific Crest Trail 2 years ago, it's kind of altering and warping my perspective on that, because it is, when you're going for a record of that magnitude, you can't ignore the potential, choosing that word very deliberately, the potential longer term cost, not long term, but longer term in the order of months or maybe a year to it, just because it's so big, it's such a big anomaly and things like that. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know if that's, you know, more reserved to be the proverbial swan song, or whether there's room to kind of do multiples of these just because the data set is so small, right? And it's just a very small number of people that do these. And you can kind of, I mean, even if you just look at the way Scott Jurek recovered after the AT, where he's like drinking beer and eating ice cream, you know, the day afterwards, and he's walking around relatively normally. You compare that to Tim, who, like, we almost put him in the freaking hospital. Like, it was like, can you poop? You know, is your temperature normal? Like, very basic bodily function type of things for like weeks afterwards. So you kind of compare those two, and you can't, you know, those two directional arrows are going in the opposite, you know, polar opposite directions, and you can't just average them to come up with a scenario for what to do. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know whether it needs to be reserved or not, other than to say it is a big commitment just from doing the project itself. You know, just the sheer time that it takes to do it. You've got to kind of have those resources. But also, you need, you know, if you're going for an unsupported attempt, obviously, a supported attempt, obviously, you need other people to kind of come to the table to help you. Those are big asks, and you can only do that, you know, so frequently before burning through all of your, you know, brownie points with your friends and significant others.
Are there, like, just based on what you've observed, are there risks for irreversible, like, endocrine system injuries and stuff like that? Or like, yeah, like when you go into these things, are you basically like risking some sort of overtraining or overracing syndrome that you can't come back from?
Yeah, I mean, there's reasonable literature to suggest that. I mean, my colleague Nick Tiller actually wrote one of these papers, and I had him on my podcast to discuss this as well. And the way he described it is that many or most of the deleterious health consequences that happen in ultramarathon happen as a byproduct of the differential between the training and the actual event. So the training, people don't have normally people don't have deleterious events kind of like happen to them. That's kind of very clear. People can handle high training loads for many, many years and be quite healthy. But because there is such a big differential between kind of the baseline training and the stress of the actual race, the repeated stresses of these big ultra marathons, 100K, 100 mile, and things like that tend to be, or at least appears, tend to be what are the causes of some of these long-term, you know, health consequences. So if you extrapolate that logic even further to the 200 mile distance and these like long FKT types of things, and if you're concerned about long-term health, which most of us, not all of us, but like most of us are, you'd be well served to take a relatively cautious and calculated approach to that versus trying to do them all like earlier in your career from a long-term athletic development standpoint, like that patterning that I was talking about earlier, where you're kind of racing to race. This is, or you're learning to race and using the frequency of racing to facilitate that. This is an example where you would not try to do that, because there is a lot of data indicating that could be problematic.
Switching gears, this is a prediction question. How does the profession of ultra running coach look different in 2030 in your estimation?
It's 7 years from now. I think you're going to have to do it professionally. We've seen this in our cycling and our triathlon cohorts to a large extent as well. We're not going to see as much of the I'm doing coaching to as a side hustle to kind of fill my income gap between this and that. You're just going to see it. And that's what the majority of ultra running coaching is right now. And in fact, if you look at the professional runners, the elite runners that are coaching, a large reason, not the only reason, but a large reason they are coaching is because they can only earn so much as a professional runner, and they've got to earn something in addition to that somewhere else. And that somewhere else, it's a very easy fill to actually coach. They can live off their name recognition and their brand recognition and things like that as an elite athlete. There's kind of easy, you know, adoption into the marketplace because of that. I think you're going to see less of not only the elite athletes also trying to coach, because then they'll also have the opportunity to just earn a greater living, you know, only running, so to speak. But also the coaches that are out there kind of doing it as a side hustle, not to say that they won't be there, but there'll just be fewer and fewer of them, partially because I think that the customer is going to command it more. The customer is going to say, listen, I want a professional. I don't want a person who's only coaching 10 hours a week working with me. I want somebody who's doing 40 hours a week coaching, working with me, just like you would any other craft, right? A plumber, an electrician, you know, any other craft. Like if I want somebody to freaking rewire the electrical system in my house, I'm hiring a professional electrician. I'm not hiring somebody that does it as a side hustle, right? I mean, I'm hiring somebody who, like, this is what they do for a living. I just think that you're going to see more of that in the future, just a greater proportion of that in the future, because the customer is going to demand it. And also the economy is such that people can actually earn a full-time living coaching, which is, I'm not going to say it's not hard, like extremely hard now, but the opportunity is going to be greater because it's just more accepted kind of going into the future, that most people can look at it and go, yeah, this is a rewarding career. I don't have to do anything else, so I might as well do this full time.
Yeah, I think you mentioned it there. I had always wondered if the rise of the athlete coach was really just a temporary phenomenon, and it's sort of like a symptom of just not being compensated well enough as an athlete. And once that switches, you'll see a significant drop off.
I do think that that's the case. I mean, a lot of them, you know, this is going to be another one of those like hated comments or whatever. I don't think that those athletes are doing it like nefariously. I don't think they're getting into coaching like with ill intent or whatever, but they are doing it from the standpoint of, I'm a professional athlete. I can't earn 100% of my income being a professional athlete. How else am I going to have a stopgap? I can do anything. I could be a freaking Uber driver, or I could be a coach and kind of be, you know, involved in the community. It's just an easy fill. And many of those elite athletes, not all of them, but many of them are great coaches. Let's just kind of get that out of the way. A lot of them are not. And I will absolutely stick my stake in the ground in that. A lot of them are not very good coaches. They don't serve their athletes well because they don't treat it as a profession, and because they're just kind of like resting on their own, you know, athletic accolades, so to speak. Once again, they're not doing it nefariously. They're just not doing their job as a coach, or their profession, what I would call their profession or their craft as a coach. very well because they're having to bifurcate their time across so many different things. But as the sport becomes more professionalized and you just see more professionals do it, you are going to see a just less of that. Just look at the marathon world. You know, yep. Those professional athletes, not a lot of them coach, hardly any of them actually coach, you know? So, and it's because they can earn a profession, like kind of like running for a living. And they realize that they don't, you know, that their time is better spent just running and eating and sleeping, essentially.
Well, Jason, this has been an awesome conversation. Really appreciate your time. We'll make sure to link to all of your relevant socials in the show notes. I guess the last question I have for you, is there anything else that we haven't talked about in this conversation that you're either excited about or you're passionate about, or maybe just the ultra running community is overlooking and they should be paying attention?
Well, I've been on record for saying this. I do think solving this anti-doping problem is at a critical inflection point. There's been enough work, enough groundwork it kind of put into it right now. A very reasonable, effective, economically viable framework has been flushed out by USADA and myself and another, you know, a small handful of other individuals. That's not to say that it's final, right, or it's permanent, but it's at the point where people really need to start to actually roll up their sleeves, you know, sink their hands into some elbow grease and actually get this thing freaking done. The more that it sits on the table and gets stale, the less people are interested in it, and the momentum starts to stall. And the reason I think that that's so critical right now is not only because the momentum is there, and I think it's easier right now to drag it across the finish line than it is going to be if it does get stale. But I also do think the whole community, we are going to absolutely kick ourselves 10 years from now if we have to unwind a big problem when it is a big problem, as opposed to getting out in front of it when it's not a problem at all. We are never going to forgive ourselves for it. I'm going to be in this ecosystem. I'm going to be a part of this community for longer than that 10-year period, probably for the next, you know, I'm 45 right now, so probably for the next 25 years or something like that. I'm like maybe midway through my coaching career. And I will be personally remiss if nothing happens right now. And every single person out there, every podcaster, every brand, every athlete, if we don't do something now, 10 years from now, I guarantee you, you're going to regret not being a part of the solution, as opposed to just bringing up what all the problems are. So I think that that's the thing that's kind of staring us in the face. You know, I can come up with a whole host of things that are secondary or tertiary, but I just think that that's such a big driver right now and is going to be so problematic in the future that we need to put some elbow grease. All the other things, the commercialization of the races and the Ironmanization, things like that, those tend to come out in the wash through, you know, the consumer kind of has their choice there, and you just got to let time sort it out and kind of step back and, you know, see how it shakes out. This is something where people have to put in the work. We can't just step back and let the story unfold through its natural course. We got to freaking dig trenches and divert the water where we want to divert the water and spend our time where we want to spend the time. Otherwise, it's just going to kind of go awry.
Thanks for listening. Before we sign off, if you are a fan of the show, please consider supporting us with a rating and a review in your podcast player, a donation on Patreon, or the use of our sponsor discount codes in the show notes. We really appreciate your support. Thank you so much for listening. And until next time, I'm your host, Finn Melanson, and you have been listening to the Single Track Podcast.